Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, psychic, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio television talk show personality. She brings to the airwaves talented people from around the world who share their insights and experiences with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna.
Hello and welcome. This evening, we are going to be having a conversation with a gentleman who has written a book called Carrying the Tiger. Now, it's a memoir, but it's more than just a memoir. It is a very honest, forthright, clearly stated writing about a man and his journey with a woman that ended up being the center and total, total, complete aspect of his life as a partner. This is a story that when you read it, it is something that not only touches your heart, but makes you aware of so many different things that we're inclined to ignore, especially if our loved one is very, very ill. I want to welcome to the show Tony Stewart. Tony, you're quite an accomplished man. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Donna. I think you're quite an accomplished woman from what I've heard of the intro, and I'm very happy to be here.
You have done award-winning films. You have gotten reviews in the New York Times. You have been engaged deeply in technology. You have dealt directly with some of the largest nonprofit charities, and you've spoken at different places in the world. You came out with this book, Carrying the Tiger, and it was quite a read for me when I was going through it, because as a man, you'd have done something that many, many men are not willing to do. And that is to be upfront about your vulnerabilities. This is something that when I was reading it, I thought, this is such a significant book. You have so much in it relative to so many different things. I would like for you to share with my audience first how you met and married your love of your life, Lynn. And you were married for how many years? Give us a little bit of that background.
Sure. I met Lynn in 1985 in a chance encounter at the Columbia University swimming pool, where we both swam for exercise. I was on the rebound from a divorce, and at that moment was talking to basically every pretty woman I saw, hoping to prove to myself that I'm still an attractive guy. And so I talked to this woman who I saw there regularly, made some innocuous comment, and she mistakenly thought that I was pursuing her, and she thought, oh, that's all right, this guy looks okay. So she stopped the next day and gave me an opportunity to talk to her, which she never would have done if she had realized that I was just randomly talking to everyone, trying to just get people to smile at me. And we had a great conversation and started dating. We were married 2 years later. There was just something about her that made me feel whole and happy and also relaxed in a way I hadn't. I was 29 at the time. She was older than that, 39. She thought she would never have another relationship. And instead, we were together. We were together about 30 years before she was diagnosed with cancer, which is when the book starts in 2014. And then lived with cancer for about 5 more years, which is the whole first half of the book. What that was like for us.
Yes, and I found it very, very interesting. And the two of you traveled to different countries. 30 years with someone, you really get to know them quite well. And the two of you had the kind of a relationship that a lot of people would have said, my goodness, you married a woman older than you. Well, I met a gentleman, and this was a number of years ago, that married a woman that was actually 20 years older than he was. And they had been, when I met them, you know, she was substantially older than, obviously, mm-hmm. than he was. So when he was in his 60s, she was in her 80s. And yeah. they had a very good marriage, but it was very difficult for him when he found that she was going to be more than likely making the exit in life earlier than he will. So this is opposite of what many times people will think will work in a relationship. And the two of you, you and Lynn, had a very good, healthy, positive relationship. And the age difference really wasn't significant. There was that harmony between the two of you. And I'm not saying you didn't have your ups and downs as a couple, because everybody does. It is more than that. There was this bond that was established between the two of you, and it was strong. It was extremely strong. When Lynn was diagnosed mm-hmm. with cancer, it was something that totally shook her down to the very core of her being, because it was stage 4 cancer. She didn't have anything that gave any signal about having a cancer, and it just was a real shock, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a complete shock. We felt shattered. She was 69 at the time, but as with so many of us in this day and age, 69 is no longer, quote, old. I mean, she was very active, lots of exercise, hadn't smoked in 30 or 40 years, which is relevant because it was lung cancer that she was found to have. And so this just came out of nowhere for us, shocked us, scared us, shook us to the bone.
Mm-hmm. When this was in its very first part of discovery and, oh my goodness, you know, you maybe will live 6 months. I mean, mm-hmm. all of these thoughts go on. This was such a huge shock for you. And then she starts going to specialists. Now, the two of you did not have any children. That's no big deal in my mind's eye, one way or the other. But she was an incredible artist. The art that you show in the book is just absolutely amazing. And she was very successful at it. She had a number of friends, and this was great. So when she's given this verdict, it mm-hmm. really rattled, again, down to the bare bones, because what do you do? I mean, that right there is a death verdict, and yet she lived for 5-6 more years. Yeah. And what she went through was just incredible. What motivated you to keep a diary?
That's a really interesting question, and in some ways is the beginning of the whole journey towards my being emotionally open in this book. It started with just a desire to keep our friends informed in a way that was, we were getting killed with all the emails going back and forth. If you have a lot of friends and you're open with them and you have a health crisis, you will find that suddenly there are a lot of emails to all of your different friends. Mm-hmm. And someone told us about a website called Caring Bridge, where you could set up a kind of a little private social media site where I could post updates about what had happened, and our friends could read them, and then they could write comments, just like happens on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started doing that purely to keep our friends informed, and Lynn asked me to write the posts. She was very happy for everyone to know about what was going on with her, but she didn't feel so comfortable sitting down and writing them. And so that was the beginning of my diary. I didn't write it for me. I wrote it to tell other people what was going on. And then it just kind of grew from there over the next 6-7, actually, the book spans close to 10 years.
Yes,
and it
does.
All derives from those posts, although there's a lot more in Carrying the Tiger, the book, than there was in the posts.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the diary from which I was able to draw everything going forward.
Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Now, you're located where? Where were you at the time when you started going to the cancer center? In New York?
We had the very good luck to be located in Manhattan, on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in New York City, in a quiet residential neighborhood. For those who don't know the city, it isn't all like what you see on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And Memorial Sloan Kettering is a subway ride from here, or a taxi ride. It was very easy for us to get there, so we were incredibly lucky that we were able to go to a major cancer center without having to drive for hours, as so many people would have to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sloan Kettering, from what you state in your book, offers, and this was a godsend for you, because it offered the support financially. When you start getting into terminal illnesses, being a part of experiential, you know, clinics and treatments, and you're basically a guinea pig, which is what happened with Lynn.
Yes.
She did things that, of course, without knowing what you know today, maybe you would not have done. And when I was going through reading your material, I thought to myself, I surely hope that we have gained some understanding about all of these different cancers that exist. Because what may be one cancer with one person is not with another.
Yes.
And I feel, this is my bias, that we actually have an epidemic of it at this time. I don't hear it stated like that, but I feel it is there because there is all of this, number one, mutations of cancer, all different expressions of it attacking different points of the body. Cancer is a very intelligent disease, and mm-hmm. it will sometimes go dormant and then be sending out feelers as to where it could possibly occupy and take over, because it's a parasitic, again, these are my words, a parasitic form of life that needs a host to be able to stay alive. And so as human beings, when we are attacked by this, sometimes it works very quietly. Other times it will do all kinds of expressions. If you're fortunate enough, or maybe you're able to discover this on an early phase, you may be able to live 20, 30, 40, 50 years longer. On the other hand, you may not, dependent on what it is, because they have their own, the cancers, and I use the plural specifically, have their own personality. And that is going to be a statement. A lot of people are going to say, gee, you talk about it like it's a person. It's a life form. If it wasn't a life form, it wouldn't be able to eat you alive. And that's crude, but that's how I feel about it. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I partly agree with you, and I partly see it a little differently, but it comes to the same thing in the end. I'm very aware that cancer starts as one of your own cells mutating, and that this thing that's growing inside you, which feels very much like an enemy creature, is in fact based on your own cells. It came out of you, possibly because of bad luck that wouldn't, not even affected by your environment, that just some cell, you know, there's like evolution going on inside you. Your cells are dividing all the time. And just like evolution with, you know, over millennia with animals, and every now and then one of those cells mutates, and usually that's meaningless and it just dies. But sometimes you have bad luck and the cell becomes the beginning of cancer, and then it spawns more of itself. And those things grow like crazy and act exactly like a parasite that has entered your body. Sometimes it's triggered by your environment, or, you know, smoking or other things that you, the substances or whatever, things that happen to you where you live. Sometimes it's your parents had it and they passed it down. And sometimes it's just the bad luck. And part of the epidemic, and I agree with you about this feeling, is as we as a society get healthier longer and grow older, along with the growth in dementia that happens as people are just naturally older and their minds start to go, we also have a growth in cancer. Because as you get older, that's giving your cells more time to mutate in your whole life. Your life has gotten longer, and you see more people getting cancers that show up. So I totally agree with the feeling that, oh my gosh, there's so much more. But I tend to think, yeah, partly it's environmental because we've messed up so much of our environment in so many places, and that affects people and the way we live and what we eat. But partly it's also just like we got older, Mm-hmm. This is one of the side effects.
Mm-hmm. One of the aspects that I think one day is going to be totally gone is the treatment with chemo and radiation.
Yes.
And we're all individuals, and you go into so much detail that I think it gives anyone who is reading, if they really read with thoughtfulness, an understanding that physicians, the medical community, honest to goodness, does not have the answers to a lot of what goes on. So what are they going to do? They're going to try to experiment on someone. But what may work with one person will be utterly death-defying in some respects. It will be with another person, it guarantees they're just not, their chassis, just their body, is just not going to survive this.
Exactly.
And that's what happened with Lynn, because she was given radiation therapy. And later on, and it wasn't all that much later, her bones started disintegrating, and there was a particular term that was given for that condition. And the doctors that had given her the treatment in the beginning, because that is the tool that they knew could do something for her, that is not the case. And it's that process that often we have to go through.
Yes. The dealing with something as sneaky and complicated and deadly as cancer, each person's individual instance of a type of cancer is in fact different from everyone else's, and they take their best guess. They do a genetic analysis if you're at a good place, a fancy place, and they say, right, cancers with this genetic makeup usually respond to this drug, and hopefully you get a new miracle drug that isn't as hard on you as chemo, which Lynn did at the beginning. But they try it, and they don't know. And they say, you know, 70% of people with your type of cancer respond to this drug. It's the best shot we've got. Let's try this.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't work, we'll try something else. And you keep trying things. That radiation, Lynn started out the way she knew about her lung cancer was because it had metastasized to her spine, and there was a tumor growing in her spine that was getting very close to her spinal cord and had to be stopped right away in order to avoid paralyzing her.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we started. That's what we learned the first week. So we had a neurosurgeon and radiation people talking to each other saying, what's the best we've got to stop a tumor growing in your spine next to your spinal cord? And they agreed that radiation would work better with fewer side effects than a major surgery. And that was state of the art at that year in one of America's top hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started living with the side effects, which in Lynn's case meant that the cancer and the radiation had damaged her spine. The cancer would have damaged it anyway, but the radiation also did. So she started having all of the problems that you just mentioned. But
yes.
This is what it's like. You treat whatever cancer you've got with the best tool they've got at that moment, and then you live with the side effects, because all of these major things are hard on your body, whether chemicals or radiation, and they all end up with side effects, and you cross your fingers that your side effects won't be themselves deadly.
Yes. Dr. Dar,
yes.
When I was, again, reading your book, your openness and the vulnerability that you expressed, that you felt, and as a man, you were the stiff upper lip kind of thinking. This is, you know, I'll be here for her. I'm going to be right here. And you had no idea what you were in for. Lynn had no idea what she was in for. But Dr. Dar had said the type of cancer she had was adenocarcinoma. And he said it's a non-smoker's lung cancer. Now, that was really a surprise, a big surprise. And he then made a statement at a later point, the cancer is out of the barn. Lynn is going to have stage 4 cancer for the rest of her life. Now, for someone to make a statement to you like that is not what you're expecting in any way, shape, or form. And the demeanor is, whoa, can we back up here? But you couldn't, because you had to move forward. And the interaction between you and Lynn was very, very important. And it's so special because of the trust. And I think that because you wrote out what your feelings were, and of course, again, you were doing postings, but in your book, Carrying the Tiger, you really give a very honest picture of your own fears, your own confusion, and your entry into being a caretaker, and how eventually that went into the full positioning. It affected your work. It affected you. This is something that no one can understand unless they've been there, ever.
Yeah. Yeah. When I decided to write the book, one of the main things I wanted to accomplish was to take you on this journey with me. The book is, you know, it's a memoir form. I tell you this happened and then that happened and this is what we felt and this is what they said to us. And you go on this journey. And I tried to write it so that it would be a page-turner so that you would actually want to keep reading. But I especially wanted to include in there what it was really like for us.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's journey is going to be different, but we just don't talk about this stuff in any detail anywhere near enough. It's like, well, cancer itself used to be an embarrassment, a shameful thing. You couldn't say the word out loud 30, 40 years ago. People used the letter C. I've got the big C. They wouldn't say the word cancer.
Mm-hmm.
We're past that now, but the reality of what it's like to go through these kinds of experiences, which so many of us will, or we will accompany someone who's going through them, the reality of it ends up being a shock when it actually happens, because we don't share this kind of information. And I really wanted the reader to be able to say, oh, and to think about it, and to think, well, maybe I wouldn't respond the way Tony and Lynn did, but at least I'm exposed to what they were exposed to, so that if something like that happens to me, it won't be completely out of the blue, or happens to someone I love that I'm helping.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
That was a large part of why I wanted to share as much as I possibly could. And then I discovered that if I wrote about my emotions on Caring Bridge, our friends replied thanking me for sharing what it felt like, and that is what gave me the courage to share my emotions in the book.
Mm-hmm. I think it actually helped you keep a stable patterning. If, you know, the ups and downs you went through, that doesn't sound very stable. But the truth is, sometimes when we're able to talk to someone and doing posting, and it was that group of friends, and you weren't out there blasting it all over God's world, but you were within that community that you had, and the support that you got was amazing. Absolutely amazing. And Lynn didn't want to do. She knew exactly what you were doing. You were telling her what the postings were and what the responses were. She didn't want to do it. Of course, she's going through that downward spiral that she thought the drug that was being given to her that was supposed to help her, that did to a degree. But the doctor that really said to her, there's no magic bullet here. This is a reality. There is no magic bullet.
Yes.
She was scared many, many times, and you bring that out. And so often in our culture, it's like just have, a stoic face. You're not supposed to show your feelings because that'll make other people feel badly. Excuse me. If you are having a lot of pain, saying, I am having pain, I am very uncomfortable, or whatever it is, you were living with that every single day. And she didn't want to say much to her friends because she didn't want to upset them. But you know, and that's where your posting made such a difference, because people were feeling when they were reading your postings that they were there and they wanted you to know that they supported you. Even though they couldn't be in your physical space, you knew that there was this caring community that was out there.
This was huge for us. And, of course, in the book, I actually quote some of the posts on Caring Bridge, and I quote some of the comments that we got back to give a sense of how our friends were supporting us by writing these comments. And some of them were very ordinary. I mean, just like, I'm with you. Good to know that such and such a friend had read the post and was with us. Lynn, I didn't just tell Lynn about the post. She actually sat next to me and read them before I uploaded them. She was like my editor. And every now and then she would say, don't tell them that yet. I don't really want to share that detail. Excuse me. But one of the really interesting side effects of this in our case was that since all of our closest friends were reading the posts, when she saw them in person, and she was not bedridden for all of those 5 or 6 years, she was out and about, sometimes was hospitalized when something was going wrong, but then in between was out and about having her life. And when she saw her friends, she didn't have to talk about her cancer. Mm-hmm. This is what she wanted most, not to keep it a secret, but to be able to have some version of her normal life most of the time. And the only way to do that, in our case, was to share it in a mode like on Caring Bridge, because then everyone had read it, and they knew what she wanted, and they would start chatting about, like she was at an art opening, about the paintings, mm-hmm. or about what her friends were up to, all the normal parts of her life. And that was fantastic, because it meant that emotionally, she could keep, she was living with that fear all the time, but she could kind of keep it in its own compartment and go out into the world and enjoy the world.
With her back surgery, there was a surgery called a balloon kyphoplasty, and I may not be pronouncing it exactly correctly, but I'd never heard of that. Yet I had heard of something like a balloon. Maybe it was a different terminology that was used. And this is something she signed up for because she was in so much pain. And the cancer drug of the day really wasn't, you know, doing much. But once she had that surgery, and that did give her some kind of a relief, but that was just the beginning of surgeries that she went through, that there was no way that there was going to be any change. And that is something in your book that I think, and that's why I said there's so much more than just a memoir. It is a reality of what it is when someone is coming to the end of their life and they are ill and you're doing everything to make a quality of life. And when a doctor says to you, stop the treatments, don't do anything else, go home, do whatever you want to do, travel, whatever it is that you want to do, because this, there's nothing else we can do. And I think for many doctors, it is very difficult for them to say it, but this was a very wise physician that had seen death many, many times. And what he did at a point, and this was quite a ways after the first diagnosis was given relative to time. And so you're looking at 5 years, and then all of a sudden you're told by this doctor, stop the treatments, it's creating so much pain for her. All of this that you share, and then sharing also when that moment comes. And I find it fascinating that that wasn't something that you were anticipating. It was like, let's go to the next phase. Let's do the next thing. What else can we do? And this is something that many people do.
Yes.
This has go ahead.
I really wanted, I'm so glad you saw that in the book. I really wanted to emphasize that point by showing what it felt like for me as the caregiver, especially. The drugs had stopped, the cancer drug had stopped working. We were doing chemo. We were trying other things. As it's like what I said earlier in this conversation, you find a treatment, you use it for as long as you can, but with stage 4 cancer, where it's out of the barn, as that doctor said, eventually the treatment will stop working and you have to find another one. So we were in the stage of scrambling to find another treatment when the miracle drug had finally stopped, and we didn't. We failed. And so her cancer was growing, everything was becoming more painful. It isn't that the doctor's statement came out of the blue. The previous few months had been like torture. And his very gentle statement, sometimes you have to say enough is enough, and I think this might be one of those times, which was beautifully phrased to us. Lynn was ready, and I wanted her to go back into the hospital for, like, can we do a little more radiation? Can we get a little more? Can I have more time with you? And luckily, I did not win that argument. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really an argument. Mm-hmm. It was her body, her choice, and the doctor was right. And Lynn died just a few weeks later. But I really wanted to say for the listeners, there's a lot of joy and a lot of beauty in this process, and I hope in the book, because I was listening to you describe, it is, of course, about everything you said, but I also wanted to include in the book the funny moments, the jokes, those moments when everything was working and we really saw the beauty in the world more than we ever had before, and what I think was the most beautiful few weeks of my life, which was actually hospice. And instead of being all glum and depressing and horrible, it was a special spiritual time in which we were saying goodbye to each other, and I helped her have the best possible end. Mm-hmm. And that's like the highlight of my whole life. And I tried to show that that can happen by describing it.
And you also had a conversation with her, and she knew she was dying.
Yes.
I mean, you know when your life is ending. You know that. And this is something that a lot of people have a difficulty with. And I think that it is because we have an isolationist attitude when people are sick. It's like, oh, no, they're going to be here, or this has been such a strong person, they're always going to be here. There is that truth. All of us, at one point, are going to die, period.
Yeah.
And it is the fact that you and your wife wanted the quality, but she wanted you to have a girlfriend. She wanted you to... And then she said, nope, I don't want you to have a girlfriend. And then she went back and she said, yep, yeah. I want you to have a girlfriend. And, it was charming as far as I was concerned, because she was saying, nah, do I want him to do that? No, I don't think so. Mm-mm. And then, yes, I'm not here, so he needs to have someone in his life. And you ended up meeting a very special woman. You go into that detail, and this was after your wife died. And you share your grief. You go through so much. And someone listening to me talking about this would say, oh, my God, do I want to read something it's that heavy with emotion. I would say to anybody that would read this, it gives you a real, real understanding that in truth, or any of us, even if we live to be 120, this cycle on this planet is a very short one. And what you do is you want to live your life with quality, and you want to make sure that you allow those emotions that you have. And writing, as you did, and posting, as you did, it enabled you to put this book together so that people can be aware that for those of us that are here after our loved ones move on, that there is life to be lived, that there is a quality of life. And it is so special. You don't throw it in the trash can.
No.
And it takes time to deal with grief. And everybody has their own journey that they're going to go through. I really think, Tony Stewart, you have done something quite exceptional here. And I know you probably speak to different groups about this. But what I so appreciated was that you, as a man, were able to be this open and showing your vulnerability. I think anyone that reads it, male or female, but I think especially for men, they realize that this is something that you're going to feel. And life is a tough proposition. I don't know of anybody that ever goes through life where it's just la, la, la. I'm sorry. I don't know of that. Life is tough. And this is a beautiful way, and I mean that most sincerely, carrying the tiger, a beautiful way of being able to have an awareness so that you realize that it's something that is just the story of life, and being able to deal with it in a way that, in some way, it enables you to be free to recognize that the time you have with a loved one is that you have. That is what you have, that moment.
Yes. Yes. Someone I very much admire recently, who's living with her son is living with cancer, and she's helping him through it, but it very dire situation. She said, she put up a post saying, you know, sometimes I have to remind myself, instead of saying, I have to get out of bed and I have to do this thing today, it's, I get to get out of bed. I get to do this thing today.
Mm-hmm.
Because the life we've got is short and impermanent, and everything changes. And we need to appreciate what we've got and what we're able to do and who we have and the love that's around us while we have it. It just changes everything if you can let yourself feel those things.
I agree with that 100%. Carrying the Tiger, a memoir, Living with Cancer, Dying with Grace, Finding Joy While Grieving, Tony Stewart. Now, you have a website that people can go to. It's TonyStewartAuthor.com. And Stewart is spelled S-T-E-W-A-R-T, TonyStewartAuthor.com. I so appreciate our time with this conversation, Tony. Thank you so much. And I would love if you decide to write another book that you let me know about that.
I certainly will. And I am, in fact, thinking about writing another book, but it takes a long time. That'll be next year's proposition.
Well, I totally understand. Blessings, and continue to have a rich and full life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Donna Sebo here. We are going to take a little bit of a break. I'm going to have a sip of tea, and then I'm going to be back with you. The Donna Sebo Show is heard weekdays, Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Pacific Time. Callers are welcome to call in during the second half of the program at 253-582-5597. Please note that the announcement is made at the bottom of the hour if I'm not in studio able to take phone calls. Warriors for Peace is heard every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. For current information regarding my email newsletter, programming, and appearances, go to DelphiInternational.com. For information on publications, including my award-winning children's books, audiobooks, and more, go to MrsSebo'sClassics.com. This is Donna Sebo. If you or someone you know is an author and would like to be interviewed on The Donna Sebo Show or Warriors for Peace, please send a copy of the publication along with contact information, phone number, email, and website to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015, Lakewood, Washington 98496. That's The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 99015. Lakewood, Washington, 98496. Please allow 6 to 8 weeks for review. Thank you. Who's coming up on the Donna Sebo Show? Well, we are going to be talking about the tale of the English Templar, Helena Schrader. We're going to be traveling to Greece to speak with her. And Helena has been on my show many times. She is an award-winning author of historical fiction and actual historical nonfiction. She is an incredible writer, and this takes us back into an aspect of human history that, to me, is just, in many respects, absolutely grotesque. However, there is a lot of growth that occurred because of that time frame, and it was what I call the dark ages of human history and of human character. So that is going to be coming up. We're going to be talking about Finding Your Walden with Jen McGivney. And this is lovely. And it is something that is inspirational. And at the same time, it reminds us how we can really make a difference just by being aware and seeing and observing. Then the last show of this week is going to be about ancestral dreaming. And Linda Scheller is going to be my guest. This is a fascinating book. More and more we are hearing commentaries about ancestry, how we carry memories in ourselves. This has been known in a much lesser perception for many, many generations. I mean, how many times do we see someone that's in a family and we go, my goodness, you look just like your father or just like your mother? Or someone might say, if they know the family well and the family has lived in an area for a good deal of time, goodness gracious, you're just like your grandmother. or your Uncle Henry, you have this, that, or the other. The genetic spectrum is infinite, and there is so much that goes on, but how can we understand we don't need to carry the baggage of the ancestral self? That is going to be the big picture, and that is going to be the very essence of what is going to make a big difference. Then we've got a following week, and we've got a power-packed month, so I wanted to make you aware of that. Also, if there's anyone that you know of that, and as I've mentioned, that if you're an author, you can send me information, but because I do the monthly television show, then if you'd like to be on that television program or on a television program with me, perhaps with another guest, then all you have to do is get in touch with me and let me know what your publication is and give me your contact information, including your phone number, because that for me is just absolutely the quickest way for me to get in touch with anyone is the phone. I know we've got texting and we've got all kinds of things, but that phone is still a valuable instrument, and it's one I use frequently. And then be sure you check out the Author's Showcase, because in the Author's Showcase, you're able to listen to the interviews, whether they're radio, television, doesn't make any difference. They're set up there, and you can go in and you can find out about it. And also, I want to say my newsletter went out yesterday, and it's up on the website, and you can go in and review that. And I think that you will be made aware. I know you'll be made aware of my schedule, etc. Well, we've got some more things that we're going to share with you, and I want you to know that I'm so glad you've joined me, and I really appreciate the people that send me the material they do, because in sharing it with you, it makes me aware that maybe, just maybe, you may find something of value, and you may decide to pick up and read that book that maybe they're representing, so that you become more aware of a lot of different aspects of life. All right, we're taking this opportunity, and give me just a split second here, and I've got something else to share with you. I told you it would be a split second, and it is. I wanted to share some different items, and of course the phone line is open, 253-582-5597. I'm always fascinated with how people will come up with abbreviations. Are you aware of one called JOMO? J-O-M-O. Well, I have to tell you, my education on these things is sadly lacking. But FOMO, you know, the fear of missing out, that's one abbreviation. I was not aware of that one either. Well, there is something that somebody came up with when you want to let people know that you're not going to be participating in something. You can say no with JOMO, which is J-O-M-O. And what that is saying to people, it is saying, thank you, but this isn't my priority, basically. And it's okay. I think sometimes we get so busy. I know I do. And you get so busy that you totally forget about how you need to take care of yourself. And it's so easy to get really overwhelmed. And sometimes just saying that little word, no, can make a tremendous difference. Really big time. It took me a long time to learn that, because that wasn't how I was raised. That wasn't in my social environment, my home environment, and it just wasn't there. Because that was what other people were not aware of, is how to say no. But somehow or another, we learn those lessons in a fascinating way. By the way, I came across some information regarding food that just made me smile. Certain foods stand the test of time. And I don't care what anybody says, especially in the American modality. Usually Americans are willing to try different types of foods. We really enjoy our food. But sometimes we get down to very simple things. And in the New York Times, there was a comment about before practice, during training camp, and in the halftime locker room, the go-to snack of the NFL is Uncrustables. Again, my education was sadly lacking on this. These are the sealed peanut butter and jelly sandwiches found in the supermarket freezer case. I have never, ever seen frozen peanut butter and jelly sandwiches in my grocery store freezer case. I just haven't. Maybe because I haven't looked for them. Do you know that the NFL teams go through anywhere from 3,600 to 4,300 Uncrustables a week, easily eating 80,000 peanut butter and jelly sandwiches found frozen in the local grocery stores each year? And I just was sort of perplexed when I came across that. Peanut butter and jelly sandwiches have been the go-to food, snack, sandwich, whatever you want to use as a description for as far back as I can remember. And you didn't have to go to the grocery store. You made it at home. You fixed your own. Keeping them in a freezer? That I hadn't thought of. But, oh boy, there's always something new that you come across and you might say, you're going to buy them at the grocery store when you can fix them yourself? Oh, well, I guess I'm old-fashioned. Okay, I don't mind that at all. I just said, that's a lot of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and it makes me wonder, what else do they eat that comes out of the freezer section at your grocery store? There is something here I wanted to share with you relative to Chinese food, medicine, nourishment. I really have a deep regard and a deep respect for the Asian culture. And the reason I do is because they have had so much knowledge through the centuries that they have been able to preserve. And it's just been my personal experience in being around people of different cultures that many times they have a knowledge and an awareness that we just don't think anything about. Well, I don't know about you, but eggs are a very important part of my food environment. They have been for years. And one of the things was when I sometimes only had a dime in my pocket to be able to spend on food years ago, the go-to food for me were eggs. And those eggs, you can fix them, you know, in an omelet. You can add a little bit of something to it. You can put it in a tortilla. You can make it hard-boiled. I mean, the recipes involving eggs are just infinite. Well, I found out a very, very interesting tea pickled eggs recipe. And these marbleized eggs have been used by the Chinese and other people in Asia for thousands of years. Why? Because it's a way of preserving them. And these you can make at home. You can take them into work. You might want to try it out. But you're going to need 4 eggs for this recipe. And of course, you could double it, triple it, whatever you wanted to do. But you need 2 black tea bags or 2 teaspoons of loose black tea. And then you need 1 whole star anise, and 1/2 cup of tamari or soy sauce, and 4 large eggs. Now, it's very simple. Basically, you're making a hard-boiled egg. You bring 2 cups of water to a boil. Boil, remove it from heat, add your tea bags and or just your loose tea, tea bags or loose tea, and the star anise. Let it stand for 5 minutes, and then you remove the tea. I prefer the tea bags to the loose tea. Then you're going to stir in that mixture in the tamari or your soy sauce, and you're going to pour it into a 3 or 4 cup container that's no larger than 4 inches in diameter. Now, why is that? Well, you want your eggs submerged in the liquid, and you're going to cover it, refrigerate it until you're ready to use it. Now, of course, your eggs, you're going to bring them to a boil. You're going to you know, in a small pot. You're going to put that water in there and boil it, and you're going to reduce it, the heat, add your eggs, and let them cook for 8 minutes. Once they have cooked for 8 minutes, then you put cold water over them, and I like to just use ice cubes and just put them right in the ice cubes, maybe add a little bit of water, and before you know it, those eggs are really cool. And then what you do after that, after the eggs are cooled, you dry the eggs, and you very gently tap the egg shell. You're not going to remove the egg shell. You just want to create cracks in the egg shell. And then you add those eggs to that refrigerated brine and just leave the eggs again in the shell that you've cracked very gently. And that's why they're called marbled eggs, because that brine that you have fixed has enabled that to go through. It penetrates those cracks in the egg shell and stains them. And they are wonderful. They are just, it's a whole different flavor. And maybe you'd like to use another kind of a spice. But just try this. This is very, very simple. You know, I watched a young couple up in the outer areas in Alaska where they don't have access to a grocery store or a 7-Eleven. You know, they just don't have that. So they have to plan for the winter. And they have chickens. They have their animals that they use. And they're just like the American farmers of old. You had to be self-sustaining. And they take and store literally hundreds of eggs. And they have their process. And I saw them, I think, on YouTube. And I was just fascinated how well organized they were. They have a garden in Alaska, but sometimes the weather doesn't make it possible to get the vegetables that you would like to get out of the ground. The weather may be too damp, like it was a couple of years ago. They had so much rain that there was flooding. You have these variables up in that environment, but you only have about 3 months, if you're lucky, 3 months of really good weather where your garden can grow. And so eggs during the winter are part of what sustain them. And it's a wonderful protein. It's portable. You could take it with you anywhere. And I just thought, okay, this I'm going to share with you because this is something that is known in the Chinese culture, tea pickled eggs. And boy, they take care of that hunger pang that you might get so fast. I've taken them with me to shows, not the tea pickled eggs because I hadn't used that recipe then. But it's really a good idea. Remember, a lot of what was promoted for so many years, they found now is not a fact at all. Eggs do not contribute to cholesterol, and it is a very nourishing food. And that's why chickens have always been so prized, because as long as they're laying eggs, you have always got an abundance of food. And pickling eggs. And another thing that I do with eggs, I enjoy pickles of different types. I'll save the juice, and I'll put the hard-boiled eggs. In this case, I shell them. And I shell those eggs, and I put them in the different juices that I have. Sometimes with pickles, I'll have some sweet juice. Sometimes I'll have hot spicy. And, you know, you could use the juice from pickled beets. And, of course, then that makes them red. But again, it's a great way of preserving them, and it's something that nutritionally you're going to really have a powerhouse, and I think it's great for kids if they're doing sports and they want something to snack on. There's so many ways you can fix hard-boiled eggs, but it really is good to do that. So anyway, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and hard-boiled eggs. Hey, you got it made. Donna Sebo here, 253-582-5597. Now, we're going in for the filming of our next show, and that's going to be this Thursday. I'm going to be in studio all day, and it is really going to be a lot of fun because we are going to be talking about wine regions in Mexico. Yes, Yes, we're going to be filming that, and I'm really looking forward to it. And I know so many of you enjoy wine, and the information that we're going to be sharing is really great. Michael Higgins is going to be my guest. Michael has been on my show more than once because he's written and produced absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous books about wine regions throughout the world. In fact, he's going to be traveling to Greece, and we're going to be talking about that hopefully in the future. So it's just absolutely wonderful. I'm really looking forward to it. So we are going to have that opportunity to find out about wineries in Mexico. All right. There is a need for us, I think, sometimes to really think about what we can do to ground ourselves. And there was a gentleman that I became aware of, and he's an actor, and he travels all over. And sometimes when he gets home, he says, after having a real intense schedule, and you know, you maybe you've been on plane flights, and you just all kinds of stuff that goes on. This goes for anybody. He said what he likes to do when he gets home is make tomato sauce. And he said, it just is something for me that just grounds me. And he said, after a few minutes, no matter where I might be staying, whether it's in my own place or I'm in some other place in another country, it doesn't make any difference. He said, it just seems to settle me down. Food. Yes, that's what it is. It's about just fixing and doing something that you can do no matter where you are. And he said, I thoroughly enjoy going out to restaurants, but he said, so many times I want something that I fix, really simple, reminds me of home. And he said, I really enjoy cooking. And he said, this is so important. And he said, many times I invite my fellow actors or people that are friends just to share the meal with me. He said, it is one of the best things that you can do is share food. When I had the opportunity to be in Russia in 1992, we had the privilege of being out at a farm. It was called Red October. And when we were getting off of the bus, our transportation while we were there, the first thing that was offered was a lovely basket filled with freshly made bread. The breaking of bread. This has been a tradition in the Middle East and throughout Europe for such a long time. And it's a welcoming aspect when you're going to visit someone's home. And then when you sit down and you share the meal, it is a statement of trust, of welcome. And you know what? It still works today. It still works today. When people walk into a home and they smell the wonderful perfumes of the foods that are being prepared. It is, I don't know, it's just settling. It just makes you feel good. And so I thought I would share that thought with you about someone who has typically quite a schedule and what he found that made the difference for him so that he settled in and just really sort of loosened up, relaxed, and that made all the difference in the world for him. It can be the same thing for you. Think about it. It's why sometimes people buy fragrances that will smell like a particular food, or sometimes it's flowers, and there's just that, it just does something to you. It relaxes you. And then also, it is something with food. And I just have such fond memories of going into Italian homes and the smells of the sauces and other things that they were preparing. It's just magical. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul, no matter who you are, no matter where you are on this planet. You make a difference, and just let your light shine. It makes such an effect on people. In fact, someone might tap you on the shoulder one day and say, I want to know how you shine so brightly. Good thing, I think. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. We're delighted that you were able to join us and invite you to tell your friends and family about the program. Have a wonderful day.